Hello and welcome into this Golf Channel podcast with Rex and Lav. It's a little bit of sobering news to start this podcast. Unfortunately, PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan currently recovering from what the PGA Tour is calling a, quote, medical situation. No details about the procedure, no details about Monahan's status. While he is stepping away from day-to-day operations, Chief Operating Officer Ron Price and Tyler Dennis, the Tour's Executive Vice President and President, will lead the day-to-day. Obviously, it has been a tumultuous week for the PGA Tour. Last Tuesday, announcing it had entered into a partnership with the controversial public investment fund of Saudi Arabia. A perilous time, Rex, for the PGA Tour. Monahan said that they'd only reached a, quote, framework agreement to create this new for-profit company. Many of the details would be ironed out over the coming weeks and months. All of that now would seem to be in jeopardy. Obviously, not much to add other than we are both wishing him a speedy recovery. But it is a reminder, I think, on the eve of the U.S. Open, just how perilous this moment is for the PGA Tour. Now a week removed from that announcement, and yet it seems like that's the main topic of conversation this week at LA Country Club.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea was they would get away from that at some point and we would get into the golf. It is the U.S. Open. It's a new venue. We're in the middle of Beverly Hills. So many other things to talk about. But, I mean, as you and I have experienced over the last 2 days, that's simply not the case. I think every player that's been marched into the media center has been asked about last week's announcement, whether if they're PGA Tour players, LIV Golf players. I mean, they all have kind of different takes on a very, very similar theme, which is there is no more information. They don't know anything. There's this huge sort of void of information, and players are having to answer for it. And it's put everyone, certainly the players, in a very, very difficult position because the questions aren't going to stop. My guess is by the time we get to Thursday and, you know, golf balls go in the air and we start talking about what's happening on the golf course, it may simmer down, but it's clearly not going away. And then you add this element to it, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the only thing you would want to do in this particular instance is hope Jay Monahan the best, whatever happened to him. But it's just going to add more layers of uncertainty.
And I wrote about this for golfshow.com on Tuesday. You guys can check it out. Like, it is obviously a massive story, arguably the most consequential story in the PGA Tour's history. It's the story of the moment. We all understand why we're covering it. I'm sure we're going to be getting criticism that we're focusing on it too much when the year's third major is getting underway. But it's also a story that I think has been made plain over these past couple of days that, like, for now, there's just like a couple paragraphs that have been written to this story. I mean, more is going to come out in a couple of weeks' time when the PGA Tour Policy Board meets to sign off on the agreement. More certainly going to be coming in the next couple of months when the all-important details are hammered out, assuming, of course, that the details are hammered out at all, right? Like, you have now a U.S. Senate subcommittee that opened up an inquiry. You have the Department of Justice, which is probably going to be sniffing around because of the antitrust regulations.
That's going to happen. That's not probably.
Yeah. Like, this is the only people who actually matter in this story are the players. They're the ones who are actually going to be participating in golf's new world order. And yet they're the only ones who either A, don't have a say, or B, know what's going on. Like, it's a very strange dynamic for a story in which we know just a minuscule amount at this time.
Well, and I went back to today on Live From, I went back to last Tuesday's meeting, Todd Lewis and I did, because we've learned some more things that came out of that meeting. And to your point, I think I wildly undersold, and Todd Lewis wildly undersold, the level of discontent in that room last week at the Canadian Open and the level of really anger that was directed towards the commissioner and towards Andy Pastor.
Keep in mind that wasn't the star players, right? I mean,
Rory was in there, but
for that tournament. There was a lot of middle class.
There was. But I think that probably resonates across. I mean, you and I both sat and listened to John Rahm today, and he didn't pull any punches. I mean, he has been clearly on the side of the PGA Tour, but in this case, he was the first one to go to the trough and say, yes, the trust has eroded away, and it's hard for us to be there for our leaders. I will say this, that as much anger as there was, the one question that seems to have kept coming up in that meeting, and it's come up a lot over the last week, is why? Why now? Why did we get there now? And I have been told that the commissioner actually kind of broke it down, the idea that they were initially offered, given an agreement, an offer of an agreement by the Public Investment Fund, that if the players, PGA Tour players, were allowed to go over and play in this breakaway circuit, that the PGA Tour would get 5% ownership stake in LIV Golf, and they would get a team in LIV Golf. Now, you fast forward however many years, 2-3 years, and you look at the very, very, very few details that we have for this agreement, it looks like this is going to be a better deal. When you sort of read in between the lines, because that's what you have to do, because there aren't that many details, you look like it might have been a better deal. It seems to me that the argument that the tour was in a position of strength probably resonates a little bit better. And I will also say that we didn't have a lot of details as far as why they felt like they had to do it right now. And listening to players, and I've spoken to multiple players about this, first and foremost, it was a financial issue. Monahan explained that $100 million had been pulled from the reserves just this year to keep the schedule going, just because of the elevated events and everything that goes into it. They'd already spent $50 million in legal fees because of all the litigations, and another $50 million to essentially prop up the DP World Tour. It paints a really vivid picture that it's clear the tour could not carry on at this pace.
I think that's becoming plainly obvious at this point. It's just been such a disaster from a rollout PR communication standpoint. It, like CNBC breaking the embargo of the story before Monahan can tell the players, like that should never happen. Not having enough details so that when he goes in this player meeting, it's essentially just a firing squad just unloading on him. Had everything been ironed out by that point, and he had PowerPoint slides, he had presentations to be like, yo, number 100 on the FedEx Cup points list, this is how much you're now going to make. In 2024, you're going to now make X million dollars. Like, everyone looks at the chart. Okay, Rory's going to be compensated, and Rahm and Sky, those guys play the best. They're going to make a gazillion dollars. But even down to number 100, like, yeah, I'm still going to be set too. Like, the entire fervor, all the animosity, all the resentment, all the bitterment goes away. But because of the nature of the deal, which was expedited for whatever reason, obviously you just painted out the dire financial straits that the PGA Tour seemed to be heading in. That's probably wasn't going to change in a month, right? Like it is what it is. Why they didn't wait just a little bit more to get more substance to alleviate some of the hand wringing among the tour membership, I think is still a little bit of a head scratcher.
Well, and you and I have covered the tour long enough. I mean, they don't go into plans that aren't fully cooked. Like, this is not their MO. I mean, they want to show up with that PowerPoint presentation. And Jay doesn't want to put himself in a position where he is sitting in front of a firing squad. And he doesn't have any cover. Like, it was him up there taking all of these shots from players. I don't think, as you pointed out, they had much of a choice in this particular matter. It sounds to me, the few details that we know, things moved along very, very quickly. It was a 7-week process. It was 4 head-to-head meetings.
But if they were that secretive, Rex, if they were that secretive for 7 weeks.
I'm with you on that.
Why can't you wait another 7 weeks, 4 weeks, 2 weeks, whatever the case may be, keep your heads together, brainstorm, and
they felt like that. No, they felt like the story was going to break, and they had to get out in front of it. So that's the simple answer. Now, exactly how that happened, because again, as best I could tell, there was 5 people in the world that knew this was happening. So if the story was breaking, it was pretty easy to point a finger at who exactly had done this. I think, and again, it seems to me that there's so many details of this that aren't known, and it's so easy to get bogged down, because the bigger picture going forward in my mind is exactly what this next tour is going to look like. And you start getting an idea when you start sort of digesting those details from that meeting. Because there is an idea that by the explanation that Monahan gave the players, that if you ask for specifics, you're going to take everything that's a commercial activity with the PGA Tour and you're going to put it in a bucket. And then you're going to do the same thing for LIV Golf, and you're going to do the same thing with the DP World Tour. And you're going to mix that bucket up, and out of that is going to come whatever this new entity is, and that's going to be financially supported by the Public Investment Fund. it's impossible for me to wrap my mind around how that then goes seamlessly back into the not-for-profit element that is the PGA Tour that Jay said in the memo to players is still going to exist, that we're still going to operate as normal in the PGA Tour. The NewCo, which they're calling it internally, is going to be something entirely different. I don't see how you get those two things to work together. It seems to me that there are so many more details to this that need to get hammered out.
What would you rather cover for the next 5 years? Lawsuits or tax code filings?
Lawsuits, without a doubt. I mean, that's not even a question. That's dumb. I mean, as much as lawsuits can become mind-numbing, there are times when it does kind of perk you up when you start reading things in depositions that you normally wouldn't read. When you get a situation where the commissioner of the PGA Tour is under oath and suddenly he can't speak in corporate speak and he's got to be plain and then essentially tell the truth. Yeah, that's interesting to me. Yeah, I have no interest in tax code. I'm out.
I mean, there's just something for everyone. At this point, you have the nonprofit status. You have whether this is a monopoly. You have, I think, the actual. I mean, for our purposes, I'm just speaking personally. Like how they're going to make whole financially the PGA Tour loyalists. What the path looks back for LIV players. Do LIV players actually want to return?
Everybody
to
keeps
PGA
saying
Tour?
That. That's not even an issue. Like, how do you make Rory whole? It's easy, money. Like, that's how you make him whole. And since you're dealing with an entity now,
Jimmy Dunn suggested there was some sort of formula that would have to be used. What does that look like? How much more valuable is Rory McIlroy than Patrick Cantlay or Scotty Scheffler?
It's funny. I had this conversation.
How does Tiger factor into this if he's going to play twice a year?
Well, and if the number is true, if he was offered $800 million, like is that the going rate to make him whole? Because now all of a sudden you're kind of going off of innuendo and rumor. The good thing that they have in their favor is they are working with the Public Investment Fund, who essentially made those offers, so they can verify that okay, this is how much we would have given Tiger or Rory. And since you're dealing with the fund, which pays out monopoly money, they don't particularly have a really good concept of exactly how much $800 million is, it seems like. That's the easy part in my mind. Making those guys whole is the easy part. The more challenging part, as other than what I just said about how this is all going to fit together at some point in the not so distant future, the bigger thing in my mind is how the players come back. Because it seems to me finding that balance between number one, making it so penal that they're never going to do it again. And number two, making sure that at the very least, you take some sort of pound of flesh, whether if it's performative or not.
Whether it's monetary. Whether it's public apology.
Yeah.
Whether it's going to be an equity plan they've got cooked up for the future.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's going to be the difficult part, because talking with LIV players, I'm not even quite sure there's a lot of motivation right now to come back, because
why would you?
They like 14 events. They like 54 holes. They like shorts. They like loud music. Like, all of these things are good for them. They enjoy themselves. Now, they're going to end up in a very, very awkward position if we get a year from now and LIV Golf has become something else and they've been left on an island. So, yeah, at that point, they probably do have to find a way to work themselves back into the ecosystem. But as it stands right now, I wouldn't want to come back either.
If you're Richard Bland, 50, 51 years old, you get paid by LIV Golf. LIV Golf folds. You just got guaranteed money. Like, do you really have to go play again? Do you really have a desire to go play DP World Tour events again? If you're Sergio Garcia, who has built your legacy on both these tours and had incredible longevity, if LIV Golf folds, you're 42, 43 years old, do you really want to go mix it up again? Or you just kind of say, oh, okay, that was fun. I think I'm content now. That's kind of the interesting question to me for a Brooks, for a DJ, for a Bryson, for a Patrick.
I was going to take it a step further.
It's kind of obvious you'd come back.
No, I was actually going to take it further and throw the DJ out there, because it's obvious that he's enjoying his life right now, that he's living his best life. And the idea that, man, you mean come back and play 25, 30 events? Yeah, no, I'm good. I'm set. Thanks, fam. Like, I could see him like putting a hand up and walking away, because let's be honest. All of these guys.
He's 38. He's exempted the majors, all the majors for the next year and a half. Obviously,
play the majors.
The Masters is different. He probably wants to just play those.
I mean, I look at a guy like Louis Oosthuizen, who has his farm in Florida and probably would be so happy. Yep. And my guess is the vast majority, you know, there's a good portion of those players that just make the decision. It's just a lifestyle decision at that point. Like, am I really going to go back and grind out 72 holes and try to make cuts and wear pants and all the things that I have to do to be an adult? Or can I go enjoy my millions? I mean, and you can't blame them.
You certainly can't blame it. It does cast a little bit of a pall over the U.S. Open, though, doesn't it? I remember last year at Brookline, it was a little bit different. Last year, we were just coming off the first live event in London. There was a lot of curiosity. There was a lot of intrigue. There was a lot of suspense whether it was going to catch on, who was next. Obviously, we know now a year later, like, that was kind of a turning point for Brooks Koepka, where everything kind of did a U-turn over the course of a couple days' time. I actually don't think that this story is going to linger into the actual major championship. Like, this feels very much like a Monday, Tuesday story. Mike Wan is the only press conference on Wednesday, I think, for him.
That's fine. That's $5.
What did I say?
No, you cleared your throat without, again.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, we don't have to keep doing this.
I was like, I didn't think I said a we. Mike Wan, I think the bigger topic for him on Wednesday is how does this new future affect the golf rollback, which they had planned. Remember like when the golf rollback was the most controversial thing we were dealing with just a couple of months ago?
I think I said this, but I've told a couple of people in the range today, and I got a good laugh out of it. I was texting back and forth with a player who was in the
sharing jokes. Last
night. Yeah, sharing jokes. And you know, I was just trying to get updates on what was going on in the meeting. And I told this player, and I said, I'll pay you $100 if you raise your hand and ask a roll back the golf ball question. Seems like fun. He didn't do it, clearly. Obviously. To your point, I think, and to be clear, at this point last year, we also had Brooks Koepka wagging his finger at us, like scolding us for having the audacity.
Dark cloud, he said.
Dark cloud. On the national championship. So there is some irony there. I guess I get what you're saying. I think it's going to linger on tomorrow for two reasons. One, because of the late Jay Monahan news tonight. And there's going to be, for all the wrong reasons, there's going to be a reaction to this. And journalistically, there should not be because, again, very, very few facts. And all you can go on is what the PGA Tour released. However,
what could the reaction be to it?
I'm afraid to say. I can tell you that I was kind of waiting around to do because we had to kind of fire back up live from to update the Jay Monahan news. And I think I texted you this. Like, Twitter, social media is mean, man. Like, it's just vicious. Like, come on. We don't know. He had a medical issue. Could be serious. Could be not so serious. But that's not the time in my mind to start making fun of someone. And that's all it was.
Social media, just an absolute cesspool.
It's the worst. Anyway, I think Wednesday is still the narrative carries on. My hope is, again, by the time we start seeing meaningful golf shots on the golf course on Thursday, by the time I think the world sees this golf course, I think that's going to be the thing that really gets people's attention. Because I keep telling anyone who will listen that once you see it, it's going to be so different than what you imagine a U.S. Open to be. You're going to kind of fall in love with it. I think everyone is really going to enjoy this.
I agree with you. I've told more people in text message this week, like, make sure you're watching the golf. Like, it's going to be prime time in the East. Just an unbelievable golf course, super exclusive. It's not been showcased much on the world stage. Obviously, we had the Walker Cup 6 years ago. Being that you hate amateur golf, I know you were not tuned into that. You and I were good for you. We had media day here 5 or 6 weeks ago, had the opportunity to play the golf course. I'm struck by how different it is compared to early May. It's still, even though I'm colorblind, I can tell it's a different shade of green than I think the USGA would probably want. But with the dry forecast that we have over the next couple of days, I think by the weekend it could be slippery, it could be bouncy, it could be fiery. It should be, Rex, everything that we want in a USGA setup, coupled with a golf course that is unbelievable. players, I've heard almost unanimously use the words love it, it's cool, it's different. Five par threes, three par fives, par fours that are going to play like 4.5, par fours that are going to play like 3.5, drivable par fours. Like, it is an amazing, interesting test of golf, and I can't wait for it to get started on Thursday.
My only fear is, and I'm with you, like, there's an excitement level, well, for two reasons. One, like, I think all of us just want to start talking about golf and not other things. But the other part of this is there is a fear. There's a little bit of anxiety on my side because of all the things you pointed out. I think it's going to be this unbelievably cool, different, unique test that we normally don't see at the U.S. Open. But because they're getting the exact weather they want and need. Like, and I'd like to think the USGA has learned their lessons and they're not going to step out of bounds.
This is the kinder, gentler USGA. They would never.
I like to think so.
They're not going to squander all the goodwill that they've accrued over the past 4 years.
I think you and I both are kind of in the bag when it comes to Mike Wan. You played golf with him and he became your best friend. So I'd like to think they're going to get this one right, but there's a level of concern that I have that, oh, they're going to take it too far. Like, something's going to happen on Thursday or Friday, and some guy's going to get red hot and go out and shoot 65. And then they're going to panic, and they're going to start putting stuff on knobs, and they're going to turn off all the hoses, and we're going to end up with some sort of circus cough. Because I could see that happening just as easily as I could see something special happening, and I just want them to let the golf course play out. Because I think I was talking with a stats guru, a friend of mine, and who kind of sent me his rundown of how he thinks the golf course is going to play. And this guy is usually sort of errs on the side of these guys are really, really good. And he said 7 or 9 under is going to win. He said it's going to be one of those kinds of weeks, which is fun to me because we don't get those very often.
Well, I could kind of see that. I mean, when we talked to the USGA officials, 6 weeks ago, I mean, there was genuine fear that they were going to shoot 15, 20 under par on this golf course. The Bermuda rough had not popped at that point. That is no longer the case. I don't have that same fear that the USGA is going to go too far. And I actually think the turning point was in 2019 at Pebble Beach. There was a lot of thought that because of the distance that these guys were hitting it, they were going to do some absolutely wacky stuff to Pebble Beach to protect a golf course that can get overmatched by the world's best if the conditions are primo. I mean, Gary Woodland won that tournament at 13 under par. The obsession with keeping things towards even par has been reduced. It's more about fairness now than about being kind of this torture chamber that pushes players to the breaking point physically, emotionally, spiritually, metaphysically.
And I hope you're right. Like, trust me, I'm not on this front. I'm not praying for chaos. Most times I am praying.
I'm praying for chaos. I don't think it's going to happen.
You are, because you're a grief eater, but I understand that. Like, on this particular front, I'm not, only because I think it is such a cool test that I wouldn't want it to be ruined by some sort of goofy golf or circus golf. I do want to point out before we move to the next subject, however, there were some comments last week, and I'm not going to look them up because I just don't want to, about how much I was kind of moving around during the podcast and how distracting it was. I just want to go on record that
chained to your seat right now.
No, I'm not changed to my seat. What I'm not doing is live TV in the middle of a podcast. So last week, we did the podcast on Tuesday when this news broke, and Golf Channel was doing 10 consecutive hours, commercial-free hours, on nothing but this news and the reaction and everything else. So I was literally chained to my desk in my home studio, and you wanted to do the podcast. You felt like we needed to get it out, and I felt like you were
emergency
heart was in the
pod.
Right place. Emergency pod. So literally, I was in the middle of doing live TV. It was in between my different hits, that to the point that we had to stop at one point. Stop down. I had to put the laptop to the side, turn the camera lights on, get back into live TV, and come back. I was jumping around because I had two very, very difficult things to handle at one time. So for all the friendly comments on YouTube, just to let you know, just to fill you in.
I actually think that was 2 weeks ago. I don't think that was related to the podcast that we had to do an emergency one immediately following the shocking announcement with the tour and the PIF. I think that was actually two episodes ago in which you would have
golf's
had zero.
Longest day? No.
Yes. No, because that one was loud, and you should have put
that was Monday.
It actually may have been three episodes ago. It was definitely not related. It was definitely not related to that one. Trust me, there were plenty of comments on that video. It had nothing to do with how much you were moving around. There also has been talk that I feel like we should address here that you're a little bit too cruel to me.
Yeah.
On the podcast.
So my son Zach.
If there's anything you'd like to share.
My son Zach came to me 2 days ago, 3 days ago on my birthday. And he said, I listened to a couple of your podcasts and I was kind of surprised and shocked and proud and all of those things. And the only comment he had is, why are you so mean to Lav? And I said, well, you don't understand the formula. It's like, here is the formula. I'll lay it out for you.
It's normally the opposite. People get on me for being too mean to you. I don't know if it's ageism. Well,
You're an ageist. Absolutely. You're 100%, but that's fine. And here's the formula. And I brought this up today after we did our live from Hit this morning. It's an 80-20 split your way. So you want 80% of the time to talk. And I'm getting 20, which I'm fine with. I understand that.
70-30 tops. We're
going to live with that. I'm perfectly good. You do have takes. I'm fine with that. And I'm going to be strident old me. And it's not going to make me look good, but it's the winning formula that keeps everything moving along. So you may not like it, but trust me when I tell you, me making fun of you for coughing into your mic, which you've only done once this podcast, by the way, I'm very proud of you. And you have pneumonia, so it's very difficult.
Definitely dying from pneumonia. It has stricken my kids. They still don't seriously have pneumonia, but they have been coughing for 2 months. Wow. I fear that is my future as well. We will be keeping track of how many barbs and unnecessary mean things you say to me. And there could be some sort of prize/penalty at the end of the month. You saw that.
I'll take a penalty for tone. No, I'll take a penalty for tone. Like if my tone is not appropriate, I'll totally do it.
What should the penalty be?
Well, I mean, since we're doing monetary fines every time you cough, I think a monetary fine would probably be equal, fair, equitable.
Just wait to the Ryder Cup when you fill up the jar. $5 each time you say we. We have talked, Rex, about the ongoing tour PIF drama. We have talked about the golf course. The thing we have not talked about are the actual players who are going to be competing for the 123rd U.S. Open. Brooks Koepka was kind of the highlight for me on Tuesday. It felt like we'd entered the time machine. All the drama, all of the injuries, all the setbacks that he has endured over the past year and a half seemed totally forgotten. This was the Brooks that pronounced at Bellerive that he only has to beat 15 or 20 guys at the major championships, that they're actually the easiest tournaments to win in the world because players just beat themselves. This is that same alpha swagger. It's the guy who has five majors and is publicizing the fact that he wants and thinks that he can get to double digits. What was your read on Brooks and how many shots do you think he's going to win by?
I think I would put him first, but I would guess he's only going to win by a shot or two because I feel like there's other players who are playing very, very well who are at least going to make it interesting. You're right. This is that guy, and he hadn't been around for a while. Certainly the Masters was a boost for him, but there was something about Sunday that got to him that he didn't like. He sort of got in his own head, got in his feelings, and he corrected that 100% at the PGA Championship.
Tried not to lose is what I've been told.
Yes, and so, you kind of tripped along.
Sure, I'm not sure why. Like, why is he protecting the secret? Like, it was obvious to anyone who watched him play golf during that marathon Sunday at Augusta National. Like, yeah, he's playing too conservatively, man. Like, he had a four-shot lead. It got halved by the time the final round started. Yes, I did say halved once again. And then he ended up getting blown away by John Rahm. Like, why is it a secret to say, like, yep, too conservative?
But this is Brother Brooks. This is the guy we talk about. When you talk about that's that guy, this is the guy that answers his phone, go for B-Dog. Like he's going to be that kind of guy. And look, we love that kind of guy. And there was a time in the game not that long ago when he was sort of this, this dark figure that sort of ruled over the game. And I'm going to take all of the major championships for myself. I'm not going to leave any of them for you. They're going to all be mine. And
especially you, Rory.
Because I'm cooler than you and I'm bigger than you. And this is what I'm able to do. I think that guy is back. But I did find it fascinating that there was a crack that I did not expect. I was actually sitting behind you in the press conference today, and I was going to tap you on the shoulder because he actually was kind of asked about the idea. When did the majors become sort of this pinnacle for you? Can you remember when it clicked? And he sort of reverted to what I'd never seen in him before, which is kind of a golf nerd, where he goes, hey, look, I can't tell you how many regular season tour events Jack Nicklaus won or Tiger Woods. I can tell you how many majors they won because it's important. And I can go through the history of the game and I can tell you those things. And it kind of tapped into something that I've never seen from him before, which is, oh, he does have a sense of history, that this is meaningful to him, that he's just not doing this just to conquer the world and stand on top and flex in front of everyone, that he does understand that if he gets this next major, it puts him into a different category and puts him on a road to even become an even greater personality in the game. Like, you're going to start joining the greats at some point. That, to me, was enlightening because it's not this guy who's not trying to be not a golfer but an athlete. It was this guy who understands that, oh, what I'm doing is important.
I kind of disagree. I think he's always just placed a premium, an emphasis, an added importance on the major championships. That's been the case for years now. He infamously said he does not practice before regular season tournaments, and he does, obviously, ahead of major championships. We talked about this on Live From on Tuesday. I think it more just speaks to who Brooks kind of portrays himself, depicts himself, kind of views himself in the greater sports landscape. Like, Tiger obviously always viewed himself more as an athlete than he did a golfer, right? And Brooks, I think, is the exact same way. And he equated it today.
Yeah, but Tiger also embraced the nerd side. Like, you never misunderstood that. Tiger also always embraced the nerd part of it. Like, he was.
When Tiger, it was the training. It was the outfits. It was the mentality. It was not yielding anything that could be construed as weakness in a public interview. That, in turn, is how Tiger kind of emphasized the athletic traits. For Brooks, it's simply there is one thing that matters, and that's championships. In the NFL, it's Super Bowl titles. In the NBA, it's NBA Finals titles. In tennis, it's the Grand Slam titles. You know, with Djokovic obviously just eclipsing Fed for the most Grand Slam titles ever. Like, that's how Brooks has viewed this. So he can win all the Travelers Championships and the FedEx St. Jude Championships and the Phoenix Opens that you want, but no one's going to remember that. Just like no one remembers how many times Brady beat the Dolphins or the Bills or the Rams. Like, no one remembers that. No one remembers what Jordan's record was.
I mean, against, if you're
the
from
Pistons,
Boston, you do.
Or the Rockets. Like, what matters, how these players are going to be remembered, the first line in these athletes' obituary is going to be how many championships they won. Is it not? No, that's kind of how I've always viewed it.
I mean, that's essentially what I just said, but yes, I see what you're saying. Like, this is more about legacy, where I don't think he ever put it in that context before. This is more about, I understand.
Maybe. This is the guy who said the majors are the only thing that matters. I'm not sure why this wasn't a revelation. It shouldn't have been a revelation.
Oh, it was, because I don't think he'd ever put it in the context of this is historic, that I want to win majors because that
makes me
look better.
He wants to be an all-time great.
Well, before I felt like it was I want to win majors because that's what makes me great. And now it's, well, I want to win major championships because I want to be alongside those guys. Like, I'm going to be great, but I want to be alongside the Ben Hogans and the Byron Nelsons and maybe someday the Tiger Woodses and the Jack Nicklauses of the world.
Maybe. I mean, he's got 5 now. If he gets 6, that'd be Phil, Trevino, Faldo territory. I mean, we're quickly putting him in line of the top 10, 15 best major championship winningest players of all time, and he's done so in relatively short order. When you assess his chances, Rex, this week at LACC, I actually really like him. You look at how Brooks fares historically in the U.S. Open. If you take away 2022, which obviously he was hurt. I mean, he's finished, I think, second, first, fourth over his last 4 healthy U.S. Opens. I mean, this is the major championship historically that he has performed the best in. I have zero reason to think that won't continue this week.
And you look at this golf course, you break it down statistically, I think it's a second shot golf course, and this is going to lean into strokes gain approach to the green. And we all know that so far this season, Brooks Koepka has been absolutely, we have no idea because we don't have stats for that. And we've had to go through this for the first two majors of the year.
But he was good enough. He was good enough to lead the Masters.
He was good enough to finish second in one and win the other one. Yeah. So I think you kind of throw that information out. I thought the stats guy I was talking about earlier, one of the things he sent me is this golf course sets up really well for a defensive golfer. And I immediately texted him back, like, what does that mean? Like, I don't understand what that means. And he just texted me back, Brooks. Like, he's the kind of guy he wants to play. He wants to play where 7 or 9 under par wins. He doesn't want to go somewhere where 20 under is going to win. Like, yeah.
He's not built for track meets.
And he must have said it 10 times today. He enjoys the chaos. He enjoys going out there and having everyone screaming at him and having all of this confusion and having things coming at him really, really fast and being the guy in the room that can slow everything down. And it kind of like a Matrix sort of situation where, okay, everyone else is freaking out and everyone else is having a time. I'm going to go out and move at my pace. I think that's what makes him so great in the majors.
68, 69, 70. Yeah. He's such a smart golfer. He and Ricky Elliott developed such a great strategic plan. He has, I think, a keen understanding of his strengths, plays to them. And obviously has the talent, the ability, and the game to execute. Like, you could have a great game plan, but if you don't have the actual skill to pull off the shot that you were trying to execute, it doesn't matter. And the way that he has played over the past 2 months leads me to believe he is fully locked in with his game. Don't know quite what he's been doing over the past month since the PGA Championship. It does look like he's had
a bit of fun. Game.
But I have little doubt that he is primed to maximize and capitalize on this opportunity. How about the world number one, Scottie Scheffler? I believe you had some hashtag news as it relates to Scottie and what is a clear bugaboo in terms of his game. I'm like, we're talking historic disparities between strokes gained tee to green and what he's been doing on the greens.
No news. An interesting note, his swing coach, Randy Smith. And they finally got together last week. So Randy Smith had back surgery and he'd been bedridden pretty much. And he wasn't able to work with Scottie really over about the last month. And so last week, they were home in Dallas.
$5.
So is that just five? I think I held it in. I feel like I held it in. Anyway.
Yes, I did not.
Sure. I felt like I fought through it. But so they were able to work together for the first time last week. And the way Randy sort of explained it to me is I'm looking at my notes right now. He's too compressed over the golf ball. And of course, my response was, I don't understand what that means. And he went on to explain that Scottie is 6'3" tall and he has really, really long arms, and that his golf swing works because they have worked on a swing that creates space for all of those moving levers. And that's what creates the power, but it's a very, very free moving athletic motion. When he's putting well, like he was a little over a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, it's the exact same concept that, again, 6'3", very, very long arms. He has to create a posture that allows the putter to swing naturally. What he has seen, what Randy has seen in Scottie's swing over the last few months is he gets a little hunched over the ball, especially as he gets closer to the hole. Essentially, it's what we all kind of do. You sort of tense up and you really, really want to make this putt. So what they've kind of worked on is sort of a one height concept that go back to when you're putting a 20 footer, have the exact same posture that you do over a 2-footer because you need to have the same freedom of movement. And he just wants him, again, to be a little bit more athletic. And look, Randy said, like, we'll see if this works on Thursday. Like, there aren't any magic formulas when it comes
to
the game.
He's tinkering with other putters.
He is.
The U.S. Open begins in 36 hours, and he's tinkering
with putters. Well, he was tinkering with putters 2 weeks ago at the Memorial, so this isn't anything new. But
the Memorial is not a U.S. Open.
But we had to play like a U.S. Open. Trust me, like it played really, really difficult. If you go back and look at the scoring averages, it's probably going to play harder than this U.S. Open. But there's a level of understanding now, at the very least, Randy said, that he probably didn't have before. Now, he still has to go out and perform. And to your point, like he has been so dominant tee to green that he only has to be average, maybe even a little below average.
Just average.
Just go zero.
Just don't lose eight. Just don't lose 8 strokes to the field. On the green,
just try to
be average.
Do even par. Yeah, just do the, you know, the circus thing and just go out and look. I'm not going to putt great, but at least I can do this. He made 43 feet of putts on Sunday at the Memorial and still finished second. Do you have any idea how badly you have to putt to make 43 feet of putts?
20 strokes on the field with his ball striking. Like, he's going to lead the field in ball striking at LA Country Club. I don't care what anyone else does. Scottie Scheffler is going to lead the field in ball striking. You just wonder. He has missed so many putts this year, and he's going to have, just like any U.S. Open, the 5 to 8 footer just over and over and over again to save par, to make a rare birdie, to sustain some momentum. Does he have any confidence in making those putts? I think that's the big question. If he makes those putts, he's going to win. That's how dominant he's been with his ball striking. Even like down, quote unquote, down ball striking weeks, like he's still top three. Like that is more than good enough to win this tournament. It's can he make them? Doesn't have to make them all. Just has to make more than he has.
Well, and I think you touched on the most interesting part for me is that he's world number one, and that we're talking about this putter slump like it's the worst thing that's happened in the history of golf since Tiger Woods had the first back surgery. However, he is still world number one. I think that's kind of a testament to there seems to be a little bit of stagnation among the players at the very, very top of the game.
And he's not finished worse than 12th since October.
I know. Again, wow. Second place, dead last in the field at the Memorial, and dead last in the field in putting, and finished second. I mean, that to me is it's statistically impossible.
How about the others, Rex? John Rahm. Has fallen off a little bit, not quite as hot as he was during the West Coast Swing or obviously during the Masters. Rory has never performed particularly well on a firm, fiery layout. My favorite stat of all time, Rory McIlroy has never won a golf tournament on any tour in which the winning score was single digits under par. When you look at this golf course, I've heard semblance of Seminole, Shinnecock, the Australian Sunbelt courses. That brings to mind a Spieth, a Cam Smith, a JT, some of the most artistic, creative players that you see in the world. Who else are you keeping your eye on this week that you think could pop up and win this major championship?
Well, John Rahm, first and foremost, because if we're doing like a swagger meter on press conferences the last 2 days, I would put John just slightly behind Brooks Koepka, because again, this is winning press conferences, and that doesn't get you any trophies whatsoever. But there was a level of confidence with John that you rarely see in players, certainly at a U.S. Open, because you know you're going to take your lumps. And I feel like his game is in a really good spot. And we've talked about John before; he doesn't do anything poorly. And so once he gets himself into a mind frame where he feels like he's competing and he's confident. He was asked specifically, how is this different now? How is your game different now than it was at the Masters? And he shook his head and he goes, it's not. Like, I still have the same
confidence. Is the exact same as him.
Yep. And that to me is pretty impressive. As you go down the list, I like those you mentioned. Probably the one that I was thinking about, I would go to Ricky Fowler. Because you talk about creativity. You talk about someone who has to go out and you're going to have to hit shots even when you're off the tee.
Ricky hasn't won in 5 years. You think he's going to pull it off at the...
No, not necessarily. You're asking me like who I feel like could have a good week here. He would be one, because you have to be creative, even off the tee, because the cambers of the fairway, he's going to have to play shots into those cambers to try to keep it in the fairway and certainly into these greens. So I like that sort of the right brain thing sort of stands out.
He's trending.
He is. I don't think he's finished outside the top. Yes. Paige McKenzie had that tonight. So I don't think he's finished outside the top 20 in his last six, I think is what she said.
Nope, missed the cut at the PGA Championship. And so it is close to that. I like Tyrrell Hatton this week. I think that's a guy who's been consistently good, one of the best iron players on the PGA Tour. You mentioned the emphasis on that stat this week. The California kids, not necessarily Max Homa for me. He hasn't played well in major championships or as well of late, but Patrick Cantlay, Xander Schauffele, God, I've picked Xander Schauffele to win a major like 20 times ever since his breakout at Erin Hills. I'm probably going to do it again, but it does seem like a great golf course for him. the California kid, a lot of symmetry there as well. How about Roy Rex? You want to believe it'd be a great story. Has not won a major championship in almost 9 years now. Can it happen?
Yeah, of course it can happen. As you pointed out, you'd love throwing that stat around about double digits wins, and this isn't going to be that. I truly believe it's not going to be
facts
that. To go back to, I feel like you're kind of cherry picking on that particular fact. But all right, I keep going back to Tyrrell Hatton though, because he's not the hero that we want, but he's the hero we deserve. Can you imagine how wildly entertaining that would be if somehow he got himself into the hunt late on Sunday and the mics were right there to hear all of those crazy nonsensical words that are flying out of his mouth as he plays every single shot?
It would be the easiest story to write possibly, like you could possibly write. You could just go by his on-course musings. I would take my John Rahm gamer from 2021. It was all about how he's learned to kind of compartmentalize the anger that he's clearly bubbling up inside.
The exact opposite.
And he now has this like inner peace in the golf course. Oh, just sub out the names, and that could be the Tyrrell Hatton wins a major championship.
But he hasn't. Trending. That's the beauty of it. That's the beauty. I wanted to do a column for him on him because he was in the hunt at the Memorial, and I talked to Luke Donald and Rory about him because I wanted to try to understand. Like, you guys have been in the team room with him, and I actually got good stuff. And then he struggled a little bit. So if he somehow finds a way into contention, but he's hard on himself, and it's not as though like he's maturing or coming to terms with it. It's like, okay, this is who I am. I think that's brilliant. To go back to your original question, no, I don't think Rory can compete here, and it has less to do with the golf course.
Can compete here?
Well, contend. I'll leave it at that.
Guys, world number three.
It has less. And look, this hurts
four consecutive top tens in a U.S. Open, Rex.
This hurts me more than it could possibly hurt anyone else. It has nothing to do with that phony stat that you keep throwing out, and more to do with just the idea that his swing's just not there. I mean, go back to the way he finished the Canadian.
Rex, he's had a chance to win the last 2 weeks on the PGA Tour. He has four consecutive top tens.
Completely blew it in Canada. He completely blew it at the Memorial. A chance to win? No, not really. I mean, not on the back nine. I would argue not on the back nine at either one of those tournaments did he have a chance to win. And that's just because his swing's not there. He talked about it at Memorial. Like, look, he's going through this transition. He didn't want to do it right now because these events are so important to him. But he realized that if I don't do it now, then it's just going to keep getting worse and worse. So I might as well just buy into it now. I don't think this goes back to Jordan Spieth. The year he tried to tell us my swing's not there and we didn't believe him. And he put one in the creek or two in the creek. I'm blanking right now at 12 at Augusta National.
It's seven. That's
it's
two.
Seven in the creek?
No, he made seven. He hit two in the creek.
Yeah, that's it. Two in the creek. And we didn't listen to him then, so I'm going to choose to listen to Rory McIlroy now.
I would agree that the level of sharpness he currently has does not instill me with much confidence that he can handle a test that's going to require a lot of precision, especially when you think about the weekend, the distance control you're going to have on greens that are very cleverly and interestingly shaped. There's some hole locations that you're going to see that are like literally, this is not an exaggeration, 6 yards wide. Like the level of precision that these players are going to have, I just don't think he has it right now. Could be wrong.
I mean, I watched him miss greens at the Memorial on Sunday with a wedge in his hand, and he was 10 yards long and 10 yards short. On the exact same shots with a wedge in his hand. I mean, it's you just can't wrap your mind around that for a player, as you pointed out, is the third best in the world.
That's why a Scotty, a Cantlay, a John Rahm, a Jordan Spieth, I think it sets up really well for players with those particular skill sets. Your winner is, real quick.
I'm actually going to go outside the box a little bit here and say John Rahm, because I feel like everyone's going to lead towards Brooks. And I love the way where John Rahm's mind is, and I love the idea that this is another West Coast Open for him.
I will take Brooks Koepka for the reasons that are obvious. Before we get out of this podcast, Rex, some exciting news. You turned 56. On Saturday, and with a little bit of a nudge, it seems, Bunkmate delivered. She got you what you really wanted. Please let the viewers and listeners know.
She got me a Blackstone. She got me the big one, 36 inch, and I got it put together. It was much easier to put together than I thought. I added some anxiety when I got the box on my front porch. It weighs about 1,000,000 pounds, and I was not looking forward to wrestling with that thing all day long, but it wasn't that hard to put together. We did smash burgers the night before I left to come here. It was chef's kiss. Perfect.
Seasoned it properly. I did receive a text message from Bunk. I was the one who sent her the link, along with a message. Rex has been a really good boy this year and wants this for his B-Day, to which she responded, you're not the boss of me, when she sent me a photo the day before your birthday of said Blackstone still in the box. All that was left was a rolling eye emoji. When I countered and said, doesn't it feel good to know that you've brought him so much joy? She sent some sort of gif of a lady looking meanly, dipping the tea bag, in her cup. I said, you've made Rex happy, which makes me happy. Great job, Bunk. There will be much more, conversation to be had about the Blackstone, presumably after this major championship wraps up. We'll both be home for a couple weeks before heading to the Open Championship. And so we should have some hashtag good content to share on that front. But thank you guys for listening to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. Make sure you check us out on Live From on Wednesday. Rex is on Live From Evening Edition each and every day for the remainder of the U.S. Open. We'll have mini pods, just as we've done for the first three big events of the Year Players Championship, Masters, and the PGA Championship, after the rounds on Thursday through Sunday. That could be very interesting with the time change, the time zone difference, but we will do our best to get those up in a timely fashion. Until then, make sure you go to golfchannel.com for all the latest news and notes as well. We'll talk to you guys on Thursday night after hopefully what is a thrilling opening round of this U.S. Open.
Shout out to friend of the pod, Scott Simpson.
Love you, Scott.